Well, the Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney is home to the largest collection of antiquities in the Southern Hemisphere. It actually houses about 30,000 weird and wonderful objects. The museum has now chosen just 50 of these to put on display in an exhibition that's called 50 Objects, 50 Stories, Extraordinary Curiosities. There are all kinds of wonders here. There's a fragment from Homer's Iliad. There are mummified baby's legs, a piece of ivory with a connection to Agatha Christie. For Books and Arts Daily, Regina Botros made a trip to the museum to check out 50 Objects, 50 Stories.
I'm standing in the middle of the quadrangle at Sydney University at the top of the hill, and students are making their way to lectures and tutorials around me. And at the south end of the quadrangle is the Nicholson Museum. I'm heading there to speak with Michael Turner, the curator of a new exhibition called 50 Objects, 50 Stories, Extraordinary Curiosities from the Nicholson Museum. You've chosen 50 objects for this exhibition. I can't help wondering how many antiquities the museum is home to.
It's actually home to nearly 30,000 objects. So 50 is just a drop in the ocean.
Yeah. So how did you go about choosing the pieces that are in this exhibition?
Well, that's been part of the fun of it, I guess. It's not to do with archaeological importance or aesthetic beauty, but very much to do with an object that has a story to tell.
Give me kind of a broad sort of feeling of some of the stories, because they're not necessarily about the origin of the piece.
Yes, I mean, the stories are multi-layered. I mean, I can give a classic example of, for example, some ivory reliefs we have in the collection. It's just over here. And it's an exquisite little piece, sort of 20 or so centimetres high, made of ivory that dates to about 700 BC, comes from a place called Nimrud in what is now Iraq. Now, it was excavated in the 1950s by a famous British archaeologist called Sir Max Mallowan. Mm. Mallowan, however, was married to Agatha Christie. And Agatha Christie went on all of the excavations with Mallowan. Indeed, she got inspiration for many of her stories from the journeys she took. Murder on the Orient Express, that's how they got to Iraq. Death in Mesopotamia. And she worked with him as his photographer, cataloguer, and conservator. And she describes in her diaries the day they found this and other ivories, and how she used her own face cream to soften up the ivory and her own little makeup sticks to get the grains of sand out. And she describes then later in her diaries how by the end of the excavation, the ivories were absolutely beautiful because they'd been looked after with her face cream and so on. But her poor old face, as she says, was a right mess. But then she finishes off by the wonderful quote that saying that, of course, the best husband any woman can have is an archaeologist, because the older you get, the more interested he becomes in you. And so it makes it very approachable. And it's a classic example of a piece that has a story to tell.
You've designed the collection in order of acquisition, but that doesn't necessarily describe the oldest piece. Can you have a look at some of the older pieces and the stories behind those?
One of the objects in the collection is nearly a million years old, through to, in fact, two objects that are actually, one was a forgery made in the late 1800s, and one is a copy. The oldest, as you might expect, is a piece of stone. It's a hand axe that was found in northern France in the 1830s. And it is very, very significant because it's one of the objects that directly proved Darwin's theory about the evolution of man to be correct. Because this flint and other flints, it's a hand axe used for cutting and scraping and so on. It was actually found in layers with extinct animals, with mammoths and things like this. So it proved the whole concept of antediluvian man. And in fact, if you hold it, it fits into your hand quite perfectly, ergonomically, absolutely extraordinary. I mean, it was a Swiss Army knife of its day.
Right.
It did everything. It was the ultimate tool.
So how big was it? Because it is about a hand span now, and size and length. How big was it originally, do you think? Was it about that size?
Yes, about the size. It would have had, in fact, a sharper point on it that has actually broken off. It went to quite a sharp needle-type point. But its edges have been... It's a flint, and so it's been napped, and it's very sharp down the edges. So you could cut with it, you could scrape with it, and also you could kill with it. So it really was multifunctional.
So the forgery,
Well, again, a wonderful story. I mean, we have here, Billy and Charlie, four lead figurines, and they look medieval, dating back to sort of the 11, 1200s, the time of the Norman conquest. We have kings, we have bishops, we have a John the Baptist figure, we have strange people with sort of flowers and things coming out of their heads. They're very, very peculiar. Now, what happened was, in the 1860s, 1870s, new docks were being built in London. And the workers, who were known as mudlarks and so on, working in the mud, digging it out, were very often on commission. If they found anything buried, to take it to local antique dealers, antiquities dealers, and they would buy them, they would give them money for them. So these two chaps, these two chums, Billy and Charlie, found a real figurine. And they took it to the chap, and he said, well, I'll give you £1 for that, thank you very much. They found another one, and they went back, and in the window they saw the one they'd been given £1 for, £10. They thought, well, this is crazy. Let's make our own. So near the Tower of London on Rosemary Lane, they set up and started making their own. And they weren't happy with just one. They made like 10,000 of these. And to begin with, people were amazed. They thought, these are medieval figurines. They're extraordinary. We must have them. Museums were buying them. Private collectors were buying them. A few people were a bit suspicious, though. A, that suddenly these things were all appearing, but there were little things in them that were wrong. The clothing wasn't quite right. It seemed to be a bit anachronistic. And then there were letters on them, which, when they read them, yes, down here, are in fact just a jumble of letters. They don't actually say anything. But the thing that finally gave them away is they put dates on them. So they put 1076 or 1345, but they wrote them in Arabic numerals. And at that time, Roman numerals were still being used, X and 11 and Cs and Ms and Ms. So that was the thing that finally proved they were wrong.
And you have here a section of Homer's Iliad.
This is absolutely extraordinary. It is, as you say, a fragment of Homer's Iliad. Not, I should say, from Homer's original Iliad, okay? We should be so lucky. There were no printing presses then, so copies would be made. There would have been the original, and people would have written it down. Six copies made, then more, then more, then more, then more, over the period of time. This fragment dates to about 0 BC, the time of Christ, for example. It was found at a site called Oxyrhynchus in Egypt. So it's 700 years, 800 years after Homer actually wrote down the Iliad. It's a small fragment from Book 5 of the Iliad, and it describes a battle, which people killing each other, involving the great Trojan hero Aeneas. What's great about this, though, is that it was acquired for the museum in the 1930s by one of our more infamous curators, Enoch Powell. And he was here for 2 years. He was the newly appointed professor of Greek at the time. And what is significant about this piece, as I say, it mentions Aeneas, and there's a direct link between Aeneas and the appalling so-called rivers of blood speech that Powell gave in Birmingham to his constituents in the 1960s, which is one of the great inflammatory moments in racial hatred that developed at that particular time. One of the great tragedies of archaeology and museums of antiquities is that many of the objects that they've got, especially some of the most spectacular objects, have appeared, have been bought on the art market. They've been excavated way back in either the 1700s, the 1800s, or more recently with the looting of tombs, purely with the purpose of getting together attractive, valuable things to sell to make money. By the finder, by whoever. So many of the objects we have in the collection, we don't actually know where they came from. So this helmet is a classic example. We acquired it in the 1980s. We know it's a South Italian bronze helmet. It's spectacular. The colour is wonderful. But what was I going to do with it? So I took this as an anti-story. And in fact, I said, we just don't know. And in fact, what I did, I asked the son of a friend, Bill Blake, 7 years old, tell me a story about this helmet in your own words. So that's what he did. He came in, he looked, he went away, and just in the wonderfully delightful imagination of a seven-year-old, told this wonderful story about this helmet. And people have sort of said to me, you know, does this have a place in a serious exhibition. And I would argue most definitely it does, because the fact of what I'm trying to get across is also that some of these objects have actually lost their story. And in fact, they're the poorer for having lost that story, for not having all of these multi-levels. Like right at the beginning, when we were talking about the Agatha Christie object, how sad it would be if all we knew that it was an ivory relief that might have come from Nimrod. End of story. The fact that we can add in Max Mallowan and Agatha Christie and the face cream, it actually ends up with a great story and people coming quite specifically to look at that object, to read about the story. So, as I say, thank you, Bill Blake.
And thank you, Michael Turner.
It's a pleasure.
Regina Botros there, taking us through the Nicholson Museum at Sydney University with senior curator Michael Turner. And that exhibition, 50 Objects, 50 Stories, Extraordinary Curiosities, is on until the end of the year. Well, that's Books and Arts Daily for this morning. We're here every weekday at 10 a.m, and of course you can catch us online any time you like. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look at Macbeth. Bill Shakespeare has a new production of this blood-soaked play, and we'll talk to the stars, Dan Spielman and Kate Mulvaney, and to the director, Peter Evans. That's all about Macbeth. Next up on RN, it's Bush Telly with Trevor Chappell. But now on RN, we're coming up to news time. I'm Michael Cathcart. Bye now.